I'm speaking today with Eric Robertson, who is running for Congress in District 32 up in Dallas. Eric, first question I like to ask candidates, why are you running for this office?
Well, there's a variety of answers for that. First of all, I was asked. Second of all, I've always been interested in good government, and I think right now we're at a principal point in our nation's history where if we don't move forward with some sound reasoning and some good decisions, we won't be able to turn back from certain items. So I think now's the time for change, and I'm excited to be an agent of change.
Now, you are a veteran, correct?
That is correct. Tell
me a little bit more about your service.
I flew A-6 intruders as a bombardier navigator. After I got out of Baylor University undergrad, went to officer candidate school, then went straight into the Pacific Fleet, did a tour of duty as a bombardier navigator, flew out of Whidbey Island, Washington, was a veteran of Operation Desert Shield, which was the non-combat phase of the first Persian Gulf War, and with my whole carrier group, came back on schedule prior to hostilities opening up.
Okay. With that perspective, what do you see with the U.S. involvement in Iraq now?
Well, first of all, it's always frustrated me that the president continues to say he listens to his generals when he's not listening to his generals or his admirals. Even though I didn't see combat, we trained for combat, and I saw a lot of my good friends die. And when I hear taps, I don't just get sentimental out of love of country. I see faces. I see faces of widows and mothers that are crying as they're handed the flag. And it grieves me that we have misprosecuted this war, that we started a war based on a faulty premise, and that we're continuing in a war in a way that's going to prolong our presence there when we don't need to be there. So what I'm looking for is to have a strategy so that we can exit, so that we can get our troops home as soon as possible in a responsible way that leaves Iraq governing itself reasonably.
What would your prescription be? I mean, the word time frame has been somewhat politicized, but what do you see as the method of getting out?
Well, first of all, you don't withdraw your troops until you say that's your objective. And the first thing that we have to do is say that's our objective. Right now, our continued presence there and the strategy of Senator McCain to say we might be there for 100 years is doing exactly the opposite. It's sending the wrong signals to the Iraqis. If we send the signal to the Iraqi politicians that we are going to leave and you have to grow up and you have to take care of your own country, then they will begin to do it. Now, I think we can get the vast majority of our troops out within 18 months, provided that we let them know that that's what we're going to do, and we do it in a reasonable fashion. Senator Obama's talking about a brigade or two brigades a month. If we roll them out geographically, watch the Iraqis take control of the areas geographically and see that it's working, then we can continue, which is basically what Senator Obama's plan is. We are going to keep troops there for some period of time, both air forces, because that's where a major power advantage is, training forces, because the Iraqi troops still need our training experience, and also special forces to coordinate so that our tactical advantage with air superiority can continue to prevent the Iraqi political divisions from flaring up into civil war. I think if we reduce our forces in the next 18 months after the new administration comes in from the 150 plus thousand that we have now to around 50,000, and troops that are there not for to be the frontline security forces, but to be there for these other missions as I've outlined, not only will we see a great reduction of American lives, essentially the Iraqis will be on the road to self-governance, and shortly thereafter we'll be able to move all of our forces out of country, maybe nearby in Kuwait, so that again we can make sure that we're preventing flare-ups and that the Iraqi politicians have to act mature.
Now, there's been some wrangling over bills in Congress and the Senate regarding veterans' benefits. Again, as someone who has served, what's your take on that?
Well, it grieves me that the Republicans say they're in favor of veterans, and what they really mean are they're in favor of making more veterans, not in supporting the ones that have come back. We need to support our veterans. The GI Bill just passed. I hope the president will sign it. I hope by the time I get an opportunity to be your representative in Congress, that the GI Bill is still not an issue. But if it is, I'll vote for it. My opponent not only voted against the GI Bill, he also voted against the Melanson Amendment, which was for $54 million additional, not billion, just $54 million for prosthetics for veterans that return without a limb. And Mr. Sessions voted against that. Now, that bill lost by one vote, and that was Pete's vote. Now, that bill, we need to make sure that we take care of our veterans, and I certainly will be voting for fully funding veterans benefits as our veterans return. You know, another item, Pete was one of only four congressmen to vote against the law change that would allow your local post office and local federal courthouse to fly the flag at half staff when a local veteran dies. He did that for purely partisan reasoning because a Democrat had come up with that idea. And that's exactly the type of thinking we need to get rid of, Washington. Honoring our veterans shouldn't be a Democratic or a Republican issue. It should be an American issue. Unfortunately, for some people, it can't be.
Now, of course, just this past week, the House passed a compromise bill on FISA that's generated a lot of controversy, mostly among Democrats. Because it granted retroactive immunity to telcos for wiretapping done on the Bush administration's request, earlier in his term. Can you comment on this?
Yeah, there are a lot of Democrats that are reasonably disappointed in this. I'm disappointed in it for a variety of reasons. First of all, we held out so strongly on it for so long, I don't think we got near what we could have. In exchange, I understand why the leadership did it. The stated reason is because they felt they had functional equivalence, one, in the promise that it wouldn't happen again, which is perhaps the most important item we can have to come out of this. One of the reasons we have punishment for past crimes is to prevent future crimes. The second item that they got in exchange was a full investigation. And to a certain extent, one of the reasons the litigation was ongoing was so that there could be the discovery process to figure out exactly what went on. So now, instead of the discovery process going on in court, it'll go on in Congress. And those are both good things. However, there already was a doctrine of immunity for quasi-governmental actions by a private entity at the request of a government. And I would have liked to have seen this fleshed out in court. I don't think we needed to create some type of new immunity, and I'm particularly worried that the wording of the immunity in the bill is too broad and might ultimately be used by potentially a future administration to try and immunize people for much more overt acts that shouldn't be immunized at all.
Now, of course, probably something that's on everyone's mind these days is the economy. It's not doing very well. What steps would you like to see Congress take to deal with the current downturn in the economy?
Well, first of all, I don't think it's time to panic. The main issues that are causing problems in the economy can be pegged on three or four items that are clearly fixable. First of all, gasoline being at $4 a gallon is just an incredible jolt to our economic system. It's reducing the ability of our consumer-driven economy to have extra cash to spend on non-petroleum-based items, and it's really beginning to trickle down. We've got to get the price of a barrel of oil back down below $100 a barrel, and I think if we were to get rid of speculation in the market, we could get oil down to about $70 a barrel. This leads to one of the general issues that's been a real problem with the last administration. It's one of the biggest reasons why I had to leave the Republican Party and become a Democrat, is because the Republicans today are so in love with the market system that they refuse to admit that it has any faults. And all of us, since we played the game Monopoly as children, have known that the market system, while being the best system on the world for feeding our people and for bringing prosperity to the world, it has faults. And when we hand over the market system to the corporations, lock, stock, and barrel, and give them the key, this is bound to happen. We're going to have market extremes, and we're going to have market downturns that are much larger than they need to be. So what we need to do is we need to return to the understanding that markets, in order to function best, must be regulated professionally and scientifically. For example, the mortgage crisis was preventable. Alan Greenspan knew about these liar loans. He knew about the fact that we had mortgages that were being bundled, that were being wrapped in bonds, that were being sold as AAA bonds, and they weren't AAA products. But nevertheless, they were being sold on an open marketplace, and it was a bubble that was waiting to collapse. The oil speculation market is a bubble that's waiting to collapse. Right now, it's destroying our economy because the price of gas is too high. It's going to even hurt our economy more when the bubble collapses, because every speculation bubble is bound to collapse. So what we need to do is we need to get in front of it. We need to regulate the market. We need to spool the regulations in such a way that there's not a sudden collapse in the market, but that as these futures come through, the changes come in, and we can prevent some of our retirement funds that are heavily invested in these areas from losing their shirt, but at the same time, quickly get the price of oil down to $70 to $60 a barrel. Now, another thing we need to do is just take a look at the dollar. One of the big reasons the price of oil is so high is because the dollar is worth so less than it used to be. If we can return strength to the dollar by balancing the budget, or at least moving the budget much more toward a balance, we're going to be doing a lot better with our balance of trade with other countries, and we're going to be doing a lot better with the price of oil, and we're going to be putting our economy moving it in the direction that it needs to be moving. So I would work on the price of oil. I would work on having scientific regulations of markets and getting rid of the laissez-faire items. For example, in oil, we need to get rid of the Enron loophole. We need to take a look at the fact that we've expanded who can play in the oil futures market in the last decade, and we don't even know who's in there because our regulations don't even require people to identify who they are. Now, we can't even identify the problem in oil speculation right now because we don't know how many people are in it that are institutional investors, that are individual investors, or that are actually oil companies that are buying oil futures because they need the oil for their pipelines to put into their refineries to sell to us. So we've got to be smarter in how we regulate our systems without, you know, for lack of a better word, squashing our systems and getting rid of the entrepreneur freedom that drives America.
Do you believe that part of the equation in the price of oil is expanded drilling, ANWR, offshore, or do you think that a approach of more conservation and alternate energy sources is a better approach?
Well, first of all, conservation, and we've seen in this last month, in this last quarter, the biggest downturn in demand in America in the last decade, just because of the cost of oil. I think we're going to see some long-term changes in the way Americans take a look at oil. Conservation is much more capable of quickly changing the supply and demand curve. If we drill in ANWR, if we drill off the coast, both measures that I think we don't need and that I don't support, you're talking about 5 to 10 years by some estimations, some even 15 years, because it's going to take a while for this government-owned land to have these leases bid on, taken care of. Then you've got to do the engineering work, then you've got to do the drilling, then you've got to pull it out of the ground and get it into the to the upstream, to the refineries. It's not going to make a short-term dent. So I think it's not needed. And it's interesting to me that it seems to me that unfortunately the Senator McCain camp lately has been full of short-term gimmicks. Let's have a gas tax holiday. Short-term gimmick. You know, doesn't save you hardly anything. It doesn't put us on the right road. And all it does is it deprives us of the money that we need to keep our infrastructure working. So we've increased the deficit. We've reduced our ability to keep our economy strong by having a strong infrastructure for a short-term gimmick. We've got this battery gimmick right now, $300 million governmental prize so that we can have a better battery. It's a gimmick. And then he's changed his position on offshore oil well drilling to gain some votes just because oil is temporarily $4 a gallon. Now, it's interesting. Dodge right now has this great offer. If you buy a pickup truck, they'll guarantee you $2.99 a gallon fuel for the duration of the truck. Why? Because they're betting that prices are going to come down. And I think they will, because it's based on speculation, not based on supply and demand. Now, it's not going to go down to $40 a barrel or $30 a barrel, but it's going to come below $100 a barrel, because I think that's totally being driven by speculation right now.
I talk to a lot of state and local candidates for office these days, and I always ask them about what their office should be doing about immigration, and they always start off by saying, well, it's a federal problem. Congress needs to pass comprehensive immigration reform. So you're running for Congress. Tell me what comprehensive immigration reform looks like.
Well, I do agree that we need comprehensive immigration reform. Right now, again, and one of the biggest problems with the Republican Party right now is that it's going for solutions that sound good but won't work. One of those solutions that sounds good to the Republican audience that won't work is this new fence that we're building. Now, the Laredo sector chief said the fence is going to only add 3 to 4 minutes to give his officers more time to respond. It's not going to stop the flow except to make it last a little bit longer. And for that, what are we doing? We're taking away farmers' land. We're cutting UT, the University of Texas campus down on the border, we're cutting it in half. We're putting the wall in between the science building and the math building. The fence in a lot of places is not on the border. It's 1 to 2 miles inland. The border of Texas is not the border of Arizona. It's not this abandoned desert that we can build this nice 200-yard wide fence structure with a series of fences that you can drive trucks through and that you can trap people in the middle. It's right there on the border. It's right there near downtown Laredo. It's right there cutting a golf course in half. It's a macho-sounding idea, but it's not going to do a darn bit of good, but it's going to cost us billions of dollars. Now, the solution, in my opinion, is to tie our immigration policy to our economic policy. Right now, we only have 5,000 visas a year for unskilled workers, 65,000 visas a year for skilled workers, but we have more jobs than that. As a matter of fact, this year, and I was talking to a radio station in Michigan earlier this week, talking to them about my policies and why the Democratic Party is the party of fiscal responsibility, and they said the cherry crops aren't going to get fully picked this year because of the lack of immigrant workers. California, last year, we lost 30% of the pear crop. In upstate New York, last year, we lost over 20% of the apple crop because we've more fully enforced immigration so that there's less a supply of the immigrant labor, and we haven't replaced it with anything. And quite frankly, this type of temporary job is the type of job that, say, an unemployed auto worker from Detroit just doesn't have the economic incentive to sell their home, move their family, and go to upstate New York to pick apples for a couple of months. There's no economic incentive when we have families and neighborhoods that have roots in a community to put them through the economic disadvantage of moving across country. There are other people in the world that are more than willing to do this. So whatever solution we have, we've got to take a look at, are we giving our economy the tools that it needs to prosper? Right now, there are farms in California that are moving south of the border because they can't get the crop off the vine. Right now, in Seattle, Washington, Bill Gates has announced that they're going to open up their new software development center in Vancouver, British Columbia, because he can't get enough H-1B visas to fully staff it. So they're going to go to Canada. They're going to take 1,500 new jobs in Canada, which means about 10,000 jobs lost in the American economy because of our immigration policy. Now, if we take a look at immigration much more scientifically and peg the number of visas we have based on the needs that our economy has that aren't being met by the American labor pool, then what will happen is there won't be a need for illegal immigration. See, under a market-based system, whenever you have a demand, if there's no supply in the legal market, what will happen is a black market will be created. This isn't science that's new. Everybody knows this. What we've done through an immigration policy that makes no sense is we've created a black market for labor by having a non-scientific policy. Now, at the same time, what we need to do is we need to make it easier for employers to follow the law by having better systems to verify employment. We need to make further control of who's coming across the border. See, if the labor supply is being met by a black market, then we don't control who the immigrants are. If we supply enough immigrants through, say, temporary visas, and if we control the number of visas that actually match the number of jobs that are available that Americans can't or won't fill, and if we make it easy for employers to verify that this person is actually legal, employers would prefer to have a legal employee than an illegal employee. As a matter of fact, I think most employers are scared because they're being presented with documentation that looks real to them. And I was an employment lawyer for companies for the first 6 years of my practice, and the majority of companies that I dealt with wanted to follow the law. We just need to make it easier to them for them to do it by supplying them with policies that make sense. Once that happens, I think the American public will be ready to deal with the problems that have been created by this black market that's been existing for years. And then I think we can figure out what to do with the folks who have been here, that have been productive citizens, well, productive members of society, not yet citizens, and have done everything they can to play by the rules once they got here, even if they didn't get here under the rules.
You've talked about how you had been a Republican previously in your life, and now you're a Democrat. Is it because your views on things changed, or is it just because, as the saying goes, you didn't leave the party left you?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both, but more it's the latter. All my life I looked up and I knew that I was a moderate. I knew that there were people, the vast majority of people in the Republican Party, that were to the right of me. And I also knew that I always marched to the beat of my own drummer. One of the biggest problems I have in the Republican Party in the last decade is that they want to be a monolithic group. And if you don't agree with them on everything, they treat you like you agree with them on nothing. And I looked up one day, and all my life there had been a red tent on top of me and a blue tent on top of me. And all of a sudden there was just a blue tent on top of me. The red tent was gone. And I think it had to do a lot more with the red tent shrinking, and with the people who own the red tent kicking out folks who are moderate and kicking out folks that dare to have a different idea. You know, it's one of those things. When I was a Republican, I defended affirmative action because as an employment lawyer, I knew how it worked, and I knew they weren't telling the truth. The Republican leadership wasn't telling the truth about it. I defended policies that the Republican Party and the Republican leadership has disdained. But I also believe some of the things that the Republican Party used to stand for but doesn't now. Things like separation of powers, ideas like even the president should follow the law, ideas that like separation of church and state. These are ideas that when you go to Republican events these days, you'll actually hear people talking about how, well, there's never been separation of church and state. Well, you know, no, there has been. The First Amendment's been around for the entire time we've had a Constitution after the Bill of Rights were passed. And I think the framers were wise to have that. And so as I take a look at the administration today and the Republican Party of Texas, there's no way that my views would still be accepted there. And I think it has to do more with them leaving me than me leaving them, but some people might disagree. I know now, though, that the only tent above me is a blue tent.
Okay. A poll just came out that your campaign sponsored that shows you within about 9 points of Pete Sessions going by the voting patterns of 2006. Can you comment on this?
We wanted to take a baseline look at our district to see where we were. We wanted it to be done in a way that was scientifically accurate. As a matter of fact, some folks in the district called me up the day afterwards and they thought Pete Sessions had commissioned the poll because it was not done in such a way to be advantageous to me. I wanted it to be done very scientifically, and one of the things that we wanted to do was we wanted it to be based on historical voting trends. We think this is a different year. We think voting trends are going to be shattered, but you can't bank on that. You've got to bank on historic voting turnout, and you've got to bank on the fact that people over 60 usually vote more frequently than people under 30. And so even though we are seeing an incredible surge of voter interest in young people, in a surge that I think is going to take me over the top and send me to Washington. We wanted a baseline poll, not a best scenario poll. And so we commissioned it. The good folks over at IVR Polls did it. And the numbers showed what we suspected. There's been a demographic shift in this district. It's not that people in the district know me yet. It's that the people in this district have learned more about the Republican Party. And as the Republican Party has shrunk in their ideological base, the number of people wanting to vote for a Republican has shrunk. And we start out in this race 9 points apart, where 2 years ago, a great candidate named Will Pryor was unable to break past 14 points. And where 4 years ago, just an incredible representative named Martin Frost lost by 10.5 points. Then it's not that there's anything about me, it's that the people of District 32 have seen the light and realized that the ones who are moderate and the ones who are pragmatic and the ones that want solutions and not ideology don't have a place in the Republican Party anymore.
Okay. Eric Robertson, thank you for taking the time to talk to me today, and good luck in your race.
Thank you.